Shuriken and Rasaki.
Yay.
Welcome to Roots Reggae Reasoning Session. I'm one of your hosts, Rasaki Maskani, and we have hosts Mashariki Ramey and Jinjay Dennis. Also, on the panel tonight, we have Clovick Coulter, Stevie Verhart, Hawk, and we have Miss Pat, and then we have somebody that's incognito, so they may say something tonight, they may not. But I'm happy to be back. We have another great guest, and I'm just eager to see what happens this evening. So I'm going to turn it over to Miss Jinjay. Miss Jinjay?
Greetings in the name of everything good. I am so pleased to share with you our guest story tonight. It's a person that I've highly respected for many, many years. It's very special to our family. And I feel it. It's going to be a good one tonight. So, Jah Rastafari, we say in my house. Say here. Mashariki?
Greetings, everyone. Thank you for joining us tonight. We have a very special guest. I'm very happy to introduce to us Mr. Fabian Cook. His background kind of speaks for itself. He's, of course, born in Jamaica. He is a Grammy Award-winning songwriter, producer, audio engineer, and musician who's worked and has helped shape the sound of pop, R&B, hip-hop, and reggae. He has decades of experience across music, film, and he's collaborated with legendary artists, including Bob Marley, Ziggy Marley, Eddie Murphy, Snoop Dogg, Jimmy Cliff, The Wailing Souls, and many others. On this episode, he's going to share stories from his incredible career, behind-the-scenes insights, and the creative journey that built his lasting impact on the music industry. Thank you so much, Mr. Fabian, for joining us this evening.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, yes. And I'm going to just jump right in because we usually go long, but could you tell us a little bit about how you got started in music?
Well, it was a natural thing, you know. I didn't intentionally go, I'm going to go play music or nothing like that. My mom died when I was about 7 years old. And, you know, typical kids in Jamaica, I started running the streets. But I fell in with some friends. We weren't bad kids, even though badness was around us everywhere, you know. One of my friends, his dad was a musician and forced him to go to music school. And wherever one went, we all went. So we all just kind of followed him to music school to hang out until he was finished. And we kind of just caught the bug, got into it, started messing with the instruments just like he did. And we ended up, there was a place called South St. Andrew School of Music. And we were hanging out there all the time with him. And the people who ran the place were just like, well, why don't you guys just come on in and learn how to play an instrument? We were just like, okay, that gave us an excuse to be there. So they gave me the trumpet first. I played that for maybe about 2 weeks and decided I didn't want to blow anything again in my life. So, you know, I was drawn to anything percussive. You pluck it, you know, play it, hit it, anything like that is good. But I wasn't going to be blowing any saxophone, tubas, trombones, trumpets, nothing like that. It just wasn't my thing. And that's where, it started. There was a lot of things happening at the same time because I've always been, I thought about it and I thought to myself, maybe it was some kind of separation anxiety or something with my mom and everything, but I always had different homes and connections and stuff. I never ever just go, okay, this is where I'm working, or I'm just working with this one set of people. I always had tentacles in all different kind of stuff. So Simultaneously, while that was happening, my friends and I, there was this thing called Tasty's Oatmeal concerts, the Tasty's Patties. They used to put on this open air concert, and everybody would come there and play, and we'd just go there and watch the bands. And for whatever reason, I could always just look, see whatever they were playing. I could mimic it, you know, and I just kind of picked it up like that. And we used to go back home, we'd take the paint cans and, you know, the different kind of cans and build our own drum. Do whatever we could to just make music, you know, and we would play all the little birthday parties in the neighborhood. We'd just go set up and fake mics and, you know, fake guitars and stuff, but we'd just sing and play, you know, and that's where it all started. We never really thought, oh, we wanted to be musicians or anything like that. It was never anything like that. It was never, oh, we want to go do this and go make money or whatever. It was just a fun thing to do, and we were just doing it. And that's where it all started. And in every aspect, everywhere we went, I try to hold on to that same approach even to this day, you know, like 50 something years later. You know, I try to enjoy it, you know. Yeah, everybody needs money to live, and you know, we work and to, you know, take care of our families and all that stuff, but I have to like what I do. I have to enjoy what I do. You know, I have to like the people I work with, you know, and all that stuff, you know. So it's always been a thing where we used to always, my friends and I, we used to laugh and say to ourselves, even if we had to pay to play music, we would pay,
So
you know.
you knew
So
that was, it was something special. You knew that the feeling was there, even though it didn't
yeah,
have a future prospect in it.
and others saw it in me before even I saw it, because I remember even earlier than 10 years old, I was going to prep school, you know. I don't remember what grade it was, but I must have been really, really young, because my mom was still alive, and I'd be on JBC, which would be the only channel in Jamaica at the time. And, you know, the Christmas specials, they had all the schools come in and sing and whatever. And I'd be singing the solo part. And, you know, I was always a part of the choir or something, but it never occurred to me at any point that I was going to make music and this is what I wanted to do, you know? I always thought of myself, you know, like most of the kids around here. I live close to an area that we call Up Park Camp, which is where the soldiers train and the police barracks are over there and stuff. So from my house, I can easily see like the helicopters when the soldiers are training. I'm watching them jumping out of helicopters and airplanes and stuff, and all the different maneuvers they would do. We could see it from my house. And I always thought that was so cool. So just like everybody else, I thought, you know, if I had to think about what I wanted to do, the only two things I was interested in really was joining that military just to be able to do those things, jump out of airplanes and, you know, do all of that. And I was very intrigued by bus drivers, you know, for some
Wow.
reason. You know, I always imagine that when I would play, I would always play, I'm the bus driver or whatever, you know. But music never crossed my mind. I don't even remember at what point I decided I wanted to be a professional musician. I don't think, I can't remember ever going, okay, I want to be a professional musician. It's just one day I woke up and I realized, oh, I'm a musician. I'm a professional musician. I'm getting paid to do this, you know, and people like what I do. But, you know, and I guess my own insecurities also, I never really felt like I was really good at it, you know. So I always just worked hard and just, you know, but even the people that I thought were good at it always came to me and saw me as good at it. But I never really saw that within myself. You know, that was just my mentality the whole time, you know, and getting into it professionally was just totally by accident. I don't know. It's like I was just very blessed. I was in the right place at the right time at all, you know, and everything just kind of happened magically and mystically. I never went out trying to, you know how people, they make demos and they try to submit it and they go out there looking for work, they're trying to auditions, and I never did any of those things. I remember the bio that I have online. I remember a manager that I had at the time, he's the one that forced me to say, you need to have a bio, you need to have a bio. Because I never used a bio. And to this day, none of my work come because of my bio. And I thought, okay, as you get older, things will slow down, and people want the younger folks to work and whatever. But I'm busier than I've ever been in my whole life. I
But
still work with.
was your family musically inclined? Did they play music? Did they do something with their hands or anything that could have inspired you to find this direction?
Well, not music itself. I found out when after I became an adult that I had a uncle that played the guitar, but he never played it professionally. I met him much later when I was grown, and we're talking about what we did, and he said, "Oh, I play some guitar too," but he never really pursued it. He never played professionally or anything like that. I did grow up around creative people. Like where we lived, my uncle that took care of the family, he was like, I guess, the matriarch of the family. His business was furniture. This is my uncle on my mother's side. His business was furniture. I didn't realize the impact that had on me, but I grew up and I saw these guys from cutting the wood, putting it together, making the frames, putting the springs, this rubber, everything. They put all these furnitures together. And there was this one guy in the shop also. He was like a repair guy. He would fix fridges and all this stuff. And I used to just go and hang out there with them. And I didn't realize that what it was doing was teaching me how things work. I never just saw it. So I developed over the years this thing where I see a phone. I always wondered when you push the key on the keyboard, what happens? Why? How does it pop up on there? What does it trigger and who did that? How do you set this up so it works that way? And I used to pull things apart, to see how it worked. And it all had to make sense to me. It was all just logic. And that led to me getting into, understanding how sound and equipment work and all that stuff. And it's like I could just see it in my head. If you do this, this happens and causes that to happen. And I've just always been able to just be handy. As I got older, I chose not to do a lot of that handy stuff, all the physical labor, getting on the cars and doing this and that. But I could tell somebody how to, do some of that stuff. I could, repair my house if I needed to, or whatever, because I just understood how things work. And that whole thing, without really realizing it, it came, it I guess it kind of bled into my professional life. Because in music and everything, I could always see how things were, what made sense. And it helped me to see where the trends were going, what needed to happen, for, you hit this year, that gonna hit that and make that roll over there and do, but my brain just always worked that way. So amongst my friends, I got friends in Jamaica, in London, New York, right here in LA, where I'm like the in-house tech for everybody. I set up the studios, and when something go wrong, they call me or something. But I never really learned any of this in school. It's just from doing it and being around it. I've always been fascinated by, technology.
So, Fabian, so how did you end up coming to America?
Well, I ended up meeting a guy named Kidasai,
Ah,
and
Kidasu.
he's the one that first took me out of Jamaica, because I became Kidasai's drummer, and I met a lot of people through Kidasai. Kidas and Bob were very good friends, so that's why I was just this kid that you had all the kids were playing over there, but I was with the grown men and Bob and whatever, you know, over here, and I would play soccer with them and all that stuff. And Kitty, because I would just hang with Kitty, and he had a partner called Jeepman. I heard he passed, but you know, I would always hang with them, and them and Bob were tight. So the first time I did anything with Bob, I was out there playing football with them, and Bob, when he was working on something, and I don't know, I guess Bob wanted to record an idea or something, and there was no drummer, and Kitty said to him, "That's my drummer, you know, the kid played drums, you know." He's like, "Yeah, all right, come on." And I went in there and I did this session with Bob. Don't ask me what song it was, you know. Back then, to be honest with you, this was, I was like a kid. This is all happening between 12 years old and I guess 14, 15. So,
Which part, which recording studio in Jamaica?
well, at the time when I was when I was doing those things, it was up at Hope Road.
Okay,
Was when I was doing that.
56.
But before even all of that, I met Kiddos because there was a series of things that happened in my life. You know, I ended up getting a scholarship to go to Jamaica School of Music, and this is outside that after I went with my friends and we got into that music school. That started me in music, and we would come home, but they had us playing classical and, you know, the My Sharia Moors and all that stuff. But we were street kids. We wanted to play Roadblock and, you know, all these other things, you know, and the music we hear playing in the dance hall in the distance. We wanted to play that stuff. So we would come home, and as I said, we used to play these little parties. So we used to learn these songs and play this. You know, and then one of my good friends, he got a guitar. That was the first real instrument we had, because he's from the Stewart family with Tinga Stewart, Roman Stewart, you know. So he was a part of our crew. He ended up getting a guitar. So now all of a sudden we had a guitar and we all would play the guitar and, you know, and then we wanted to build a keyboard. Because we used to see the bands at Tasties with these keyboards and the two decks and how they did everything on the keyboard, but we never had a keyboard. So a friend of mine brought us this old beat up harmonica, where you not harmonica, the melodica, where you blow in it and then press the keys, and we taped that thing up and fixed it and tried to get it, and eventually we ended up getting a second one. So we built a double decker keyboard. We would just play all this stuff and just have fun and sing and, you know, make music. But to us, it was just fun. But then after a while, people were liking it, and we started feeling like, oh, we could do this, you know, we could have fun. I remember we were so cocky. None of us had dads at home, you know, and the few who had moms were, you know, weren't dear. So we were kind of all raising ourselves. And even though some people could look at that as a bad thing, for us, later on in life, I looked at it and I was like, wow, because we didn't have anybody to tell us, oh, that's just pipe dreams. Oh, that's not realistic. You can't do that or whatever. So we dreamt big. You know, when I remember the first time we heard Earth, Wind, and Fire, we wanted to do that. And we had nobody around us to tell us we can't. So that's what we set out to do. I remember us as kids, the first time I got my feelings hurt so bad, but we were so cocky though that even though our feelings were hurt, our attitude was, okay, we'll show you. Because we went up, I remember us searching out and figuring out where the musician union was. And we were like, we can play, we can do this, but guess what? We need instruments. Where are we going to get instruments? Let's go up to the musician union and demand instruments. Let's tell them they need to give us music instruments because we're the future, you know? And we had this attitude. I remember us marching up here and out there, and we're outside and we demanded to talk to the boss and whoever. And eventually, I remember Live Parks was there, Sonny Bradshaw, and a couple of other people. And I remember them just for a joke, they were like, okay, let these kids in there, you know? And we come in and we're we're talking to them like we're just superstars. We're talking to them like telling them, oh, we are the future. They better invest in us. We need instruments. We just, and we were telling them all this stuff, and they sat there and listened to us. And when we finished, thought they say, you're done. I say, yeah. And they started laughing. They were laughing. Our feelings were so hurt.
Oh my gosh.
And they laughed us. They laughed us right out of there. And we just kept saying, "We'll show you. It's okay." We were so hurt. We wanted to cry that they laughed us out there. But we were just little kids. And we went from that and following our friends to music school till we met this one kid. His dad owned a club out in. He was a really good keyboardist, and if you were good, we would recruit you into the group. So we met this keyboardist, this guy. We all hang out, and he liked us. I guess he thought we could play, but we looked at him. He was a really good keyboardist too. He eventually ended up playing for a band called Zappa.
Oh, Barry Salmon
Right,
band.
Barry Salmon. And this kid, his name was Tony Bennett, actually. And
Oh.
his dad owned a club in Spanish Town, just outside of Spanish Town, called the Fountain Club. Now, we're kids, we don't know the history of these places. We don't know what it is. When you're walking in certain people's shoe, you will get nervous or whatever. We didn't know because we went in there and they were, these guys were telling us, who normally play here, who shoes you come and try to fill. Oh, this is Sly and Robbie was in here, and rah, rah,
Whoa.
rah. We didn't know who Sly and Robbie was, so we were just like, so. We were real cocky and everything, and we were friends with the guy, the son of the guy who owned the place. So I went there with them, and my friend was going to play bass, and they were waiting on the drummer to come. And like I said, we all just followed each other everywhere. So we followed my friend to go audition for this bass part, and we're sitting around waiting on the drummer to come so they could audition him. And they were just like, well, they call me Oral. That's what my mom used to call me. She wanted me to be like Oral Roberts, the preacher. So they're like, Oral, go play the drums, So I went up there and I was playing the drums. I must have been like 12 years old.
Whoa.
I was playing the drums, and next thing I know, I was the drummer. So me and two of my friends, we started playing in this band, but I was so young, I couldn't be in the club. So the stage was right next to where the kitchen was. So I had to stay in the kitchen. I'd go from the kitchen right onto the stage, play, and then come off the stage and go right back into the kitchen. So I used to sit at the edge of the kitchen where the bar was, the edge of the bar and the kitchen where they meet. And I used to sit there and listen to the music all night, And I used to listen to all my favorite songs, and I'd sit there and sing. And people would come up to me all the time and like, oh, you're so good. You have a great voice. Love how that you play all this stuff. After a while, it was cool at first, but after a while, I'm like, okay, all these drunk people, I've had enough of this. I want to listen to my music. So I got a little chip on my shoulder. People said, I just go, okay, thank you. But I didn't want to be bothered with all these drunks trying to talk to me. But I was in there one day, and this guy came up to me, and he was telling me he likes how I play and he likes how I sing, and he was asking me all these questions. But I was listening to my music, so I was kind of somewhat ignoring him and singing, but still hearing him. And one of my favorite songs came on, and I started singing the song, and he goes, "You like that song?" And I say, "Yeah, that's one of my favorite songs." But I thought at the time, it was somebody like Billy Paul or Teddy Pendergrass or something. It was a foreign sounding song. This guy had this big voice and he sang like Teddy Pendergrass and all these people, And I was like, yeah, man, this is my favorite song. And he goes, I'm the one that sang that song.
Whoa, who was
And
it?
his name was Ernest Wilson.
Oh, yeah.
And when he said that, I was so offended. I jump up. I was like, "Wait, I was like telling him off. How dare you try to say you're the one that sing that song?" And he was just looking at me like, and he's like, "All right, okay, I'll show you." And he was like, when are you know, how long you play? And I told him, you know, we play Friday, Saturday, and an early show on Sunday. Then we take the bus, go back to Kinston so we can go to school Monday morning. And he was like, okay, don't leave. I'm going to come and get you. And but, you know, people say all kind of stuff to me all the time. So it just went in one ear and out the next ears. Besides, I wasn't going to go nowhere with this guy. I don't know him, you know. So for whatever reason, I don't know why, because normally Sundays after the show, we take the bus and we go home. But that night, we decided to sleep at the club on the benches, wake up early the next morning, take the bus and go into Kinston and go to school. So all I remember is real early in the morning, I'm hearing all this bang, 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 banging on the door. And, you know, I'm like, who's this? Because we're not allowed to open the door. So I peep out through the hole and it's this guy. So I was like, you know, what do you want? And he's like, I told you I was going to come get you. You know, we're going to Kinston or whatever. So me and my friend, we're from Kinston. We played, you know, one that plays the bass with me and him got the job together. And we're like, well, instead of us going to go wait for a bus and spending bus fare and all this stuff, we saw that they had a van, an open back van. We're like, let's just jump in the back of the van and take the ride to Kinston. So we jump in the back of the van and he drives us to Kinston. And my friend jumped out at one point and I was supposed to get out at the next point. So I'm in the back of the van. I'm not worried about nothing because I can jump out at any time. You know? This guy drove me to a bunch of studios. He didn't take me where I was going to go. I didn't know who, and this is my first time in these studios. I went to Scratchberry Studio, Blackheart, took me to Studio One. There was this other studio down on, like, close to Machado down on, I think that's East Queen Street or something. And he took me to all these places, Joe Gibbs, Ari J. And the whole day, all these people that I heard on the radio, I'm meeting all these people, I'm hanging out with them. And because I'm with him and everybody respected him so much, it just automatically came
Give
to
him
me
press.
because I was like his little protege, you know? And I'm like, who's this guy? How come he knows all these
Wait,
people? And
now you stood up.
when I found out he really sang that song, I almost lost my mind. I was like, what? And so I started now. I didn't just see him as just the drunk anymore. And we had this little routine. He was the little kid in a group called Clarendonuts. You know? He's the one that sang all that shibbidi-bidoobie, I love you, yeah, and all that stuff, you know. And so he had, and that's where he came from. And what
Wait,
happened is
the Clarendonians is where Freddie sang with them.
Freddie sang with them at one point. So what ended up happening was as the older guy got older, because they came out of Studio One, as the older guy got older, he migrated to America or Canada or someplace. And Ernest was left in Jamaica. Ernest was a little kid. So as Ernest got older, he started singing the older guy's part, and he would give the part that he would sing as a kid. He recruited Freddie McGregor come in and sing the song, his part. Now, as Freddie got older and Freddie started going off into other things, I came in and started singing the parts that Freddie was singing.
But wait, we never know that.
So that's where it all started. And what we would do all day, he would pick me up. And what we would do is he had a hustle. And I was like his little partner in the hustle, but I was a kid. I didn't ask no question about the business or money or how anything. He would just say, we go into the studio. And I was like, yeah, okay, cool. And we're ready and we go. I didn't ask about nothing about no money. I didn't ask nothing about no rights or nothing. And he would write these songs and give it to me to sing. So me and him would sing for some people, and then other people we wouldn't sing for, we would just sit. He would play bass, I would play the drums, and we'd build tracks for all these people. So we were going, so we would get up, we'd go to Studio One, we'll build a couple of tracks at Studio One. He would collect. Then we'd go over to Blackhawk, which is
Scratch.
right. And we'd go over there and we'd build tracks for them, and we'd go down to Channel One and build something down there, and you know, and he would collect all this money. And he would just give me a little bit of money at the end of the day. I didn't ask him how much money. I was just happy I was getting money because, I don't know what these people pay are. I didn't even realize I could get paid to play music, So
That's
this was where my
tomorrow.
start, and I was in the middle of all these giants, and I was a kid. I didn't know who they were, what they did, or anything. And I was just doing my thing. So eventually, Sir D at Studio One offered me a job. He asked me if I wanted to come and play drums for Studio One. I was just like, yeah. And I spoke to him because he controlled everything I did at the time, Ernest. And I spoke to him. He's like, yeah, go make the money. So I started working for Studio One as Studio One's drummer. Now that was a whole experience in itself because, of course, at the time I had no idea what Studio One was. I didn't know it was the birthplace of Jamaican music, ska, reggae, all of it. I had no idea who any of these people were. I just went in there and I did my thing. And as I was telling Marsha Rieke, I remember looking back now, if I knew that, maybe I would have been tripping as a little kid because the way how Sir D used to do it, which is Clement Dodd, we call him Sir. He has like you walk to the back of the building, the studio's in the back, and you go in this door. There's a staircase going up, and then to the right, you go into the studio. So we would all hang out on the staircase until it was our time to go in the studio. And I think about the people that were hanging out on the staircase that I was hanging out with. That's where I met Sugar Minot before he had one hit. I met Freddie Dear. I met Richard Ace. I met Pablo Black. It's like all these legendary musicians and singers, and I'd be hanging out there with them, and we all go in and make music together. But to me, it was just like I was jamming with my boys back in the hood. We were making it's just like playing the parties because I didn't realize how serious this was and what impact this would have on the world later. And my first experience with actual recording, I didn't even keep track of what songs I was playing or what songs I was playing on or anything. And I like, what? That's me? Because all those early, what Sir D did back in the day, and my job was as a drummer. A lot of those rhythms were recorded on two tracks and four track. So the drums was piled together with all the other instruments. He had no control over a lot of it. So it was however they recorded, whatever. So if you notice some of it, you listen to it, you can barely hear the bass drum, or you can barely hear, the earlier stuff, sometimes the hi-hat is missing or whatever. It's not that they didn't play it, but where the mic was, and depending on who was playing. So my job when I went in there was a lot of those music. He would play it for me in my ears. I would listen to what they play and I would replay it because he bought a 24 track machine. He bought a 24 track machine and he didn't, I guess I'm realizing now, he didn't know how to get the separation. So he could have hi-hat if he wanted to turn up the hi-hat or take out the snare or anything. So he would have me do them one by one. So that was officially my job. But also being there when they do live sessions, I would just do the live sessions. And it's so funny because for a long time, I never really told people I worked at Studio One. I was Studio One's drummer. Because when you say things like that, the next thing somebody goes, what song did you play on? Or this and that. So I just never said that. It's just like my interaction with Bob. I never told nobody I recorded with Bob simply because I don't remember what song I played on. I was just a kid. I don't know if he really ever used it or not, but I was in the studio. I worked with him. You know what I'm saying? So in Studio One, I would do that. And then I would sit with all these legendary musicians and I was playing with them and doing all this stuff. I remember them taking me to 12 Tribe to play for 12 Tribe and all this stuff. I didn't know. I was a kid. I didn't know what none of this stuff was. So it never meant anything to me.
So you wasn't dreadlocks at them time.
No, I had a little afro, and I was wearing my bush jacket and all this stuff. And a lot of times I'd be in my school uniform because I would leave my house, my official house, and I would go to school. And once they called, made road call, I'd say present, then I'd sneak out. And I'd be gone to the studio. I'd gone go meet my friends and we'd go record and do stuff, And because I would skip so much days of school. But then my uncle on my father's side was a minister of education. So I would just go down to his office and get a letter from his office, and I could get into any school I want.
So
And
you
as soon
had
as they heard my last name, they were like, "Oh," and they said, "Oh, it's my uncle, your uncle," and they
that's
let
what
me in the
made
school.
me just that's what just clicked, because you have a family that was a governor general.
Right, that's the same person. By the time he was a governor general yet,
Okay.
he was the Minister of Education. I found
Okay.
out later his importance that he was in government from the English had it there.
Yes. Yeah, the governor general represented in England,
Right.
right?
But he's the Queen's representative, because even when we
Yes.
got independence, the Queen still ran the army and everything. So he
All
was the head.
now.
Right. So what ended up happening was I found out he was instrumental in getting Jamaica's independence from England.
Oh.
He helped write the Jamaican Constitution. He was one of the founding members of the People's National Party, the first
Oh,
party and
okay.
all that stuff. And he eventually became governor general until he died. But at the time, he was just Uncle Howard. So I didn't get all of that. So I knew I could get into any school. So I remember being registered in KC, and I would go to KC. I would raise my hand, say this, but my friends went to All Saints. So I had a
Okay.
letter that had me register in All Saints. So I went to All Saints after I just because I had to. I got in trouble for not showing up to school. So I would just go, roll call, I'd raise my hand, they say I was present, and then I was gone, and I went to the schools that my friends went to.
So did you know Garthi from All Saints?
No, I didn't, because when I went to All Saints, I would just go in there and just hang with my friends. And a lot of times we'd go in there, we'd take one class or two class, and then we'd be gone to the studio. So that was the life I was living. And through all of this, hooking up with Richard Ace and all these guys, I don't know. It's like, to me, I could read, I could write, I could do all this stuff, but all these other things, these things that they were filling my head with, it was just about, me and my friends hanging out, music. But even then, I didn't think I was going to be a musician. I never considered myself a musician.
So
I was
Fabian,
just.
let's just back it up a little bit, because I know you said it was magical, but you did put in some work and you did study music in order to be able to have the knowledge that you have to play so much that you do now. So at what point was it that you got the education needed of theory and what have you? Where, how did that happen?
Well, it originally started, like I said, the South End Time music. It was an orchestra. So we had to read music. That was my first exposure to that side of it, But at the same time, it was a band that the political system put together, a school that the political system put together, and all that stuff. And it was limited. So me being out in the streets and what I was doing in the streets and playing in the clubs with all my friends and all this stuff, this the same guy I was telling you about that his dad owned the club, he had money, so he went to Jamaica School of Music, which at that time you had to be uptown, had money, whatever, to go there. And he went there, and me and the bass player would follow him and sit outside the class and listen. So we knew how to read a little, but we weren't that great at it, from before. But what we used to do is they had great instruments there. So after the class was over, we would sneak into class and we would play on the instruments and jam on the instruments. And one day we were in there playing and jamming on the instruments, and we turned around and the teacher had come back. You know, she came back and she was standing at the door watching us. And my heart almost jumped out my mouth. I thought I was going to jail. I thought this is it, it's over, you know. And she was just like, no, keep playing, keep playing. And she sat there and listened to us. And after that, we would come, and when she saw us standing outside, she would invite us in to come sit inside in the class. I didn't know at the time, but she kind of had ulterior motives, because in Jamaica School of Music, they had this thing. Every year they would do this concert, and all the classes would form a band and, you know, present their class. And I didn't know at the time, but she wanted us to be in her band. So she asked us eventually to be in the band and play for the class, and we did. But, and you know, she was teaching us a few things, and we were using our reading ability and stuff like that. But we didn't officially go to the school. We were just like her little ringers, you know. And I remember they had this concert where they had to present, and all the classes would come and present their band and whatever. And we played later on. And when we played, the whole place kind of lost it. And they wanted us to do an encore, and we didn't have any more songs. So me, the keyboardist, and the bass player, we played in the clubs. So we started playing some stuff from the street in the clubs, you know, we just jamming. And then all the other, you know, uptown kids, the trumpeters, the saxophone, they would come up and play something on top of it and solo. And then after they were all done, they were hanging us on. They were like, do a solo, you know. And my boy Tony, you know, as I say, he ended up eventually playing for Zapow. He was really good, you know, and he did a wicked solo. The bass player did a solo. I did a solo. And I remember they, you know, them jumping up on stage, and there was all these newspaper, and the TV station was there, and politicians, and all of a sudden they were talking about, this is the caliber of musicians that we're turning out here at the school, and blah, blah, blah. And I guess somebody must have told them, we don't really go to the school. And I just remember the look on her face when she came to us. She's like, you guys don't go to the school, you know? And we were like, no, not really. And I remember them talking amongst themselves and to the teacher. And then they came over and said, how would you like guys like to go to the school? And we were like, yeah, great. You know, and that's how we got our first scholarship, because we couldn't afford to go there. But they let us come so they could back up whatever they were you know, saying to them. And that was the first time I got a scholarship to Jamaica School of Music. And I knew that was a big deal, because we already knew from the people that were there and whatever. And I did that for a while. But of course, I was in the streets again, and, you know, playing with musicians. That's my son, my youngest. And I was in the streets, I was doing studio sessions. So I'd be missing classes. I'd go to the North Coast, go play, do all these different things. And they kind of had a meeting with me, and they were like, you know, what are you doing? You know, I mean, you're missing classes, this and that. I'm like, well, the guy that's teaching me to play drums, I play just as good as he does. He's not teaching me anything. You know what I'm saying? And they talked, and they were like, well, what do you want to do? And I was like, well, they were like, do you want to pick another instrument? So I started playing bass, and they started teaching me bass. But the bass player, the teacher, the guy that was teaching me bass, he couldn't teach me a whole lot on the regular bass. So he started teaching me string bass, the upright bass, and they taught me how to read and play. So that's what I benefited from that. But at the same time, a lot of the teachers, I would play in the teacher's band. So the teachers invite me to come join their band. And sometimes, like, I remember the bass player, you know, he played for the military band, and whenever he left to go on tour with the military band, he would have me go fill in on his gigs. So these gigs was like I was playing top of the Sheraton with Aubrey Adams, you know, these legendary places, filling in for my teacher. You know, and because of that, I ended up working with Cedric Brooks. He was a teacher there at the school, and Cedric had a band called United Africa, and he invited me to play with them. And I really liked it for several reasons. You know, I was this young kid, and here was this guy. He was very pro-Africa. He was teaching us about, you know, Africa and, you know, music. And I noticed a lot of the other people that I work with, it was all just about money. And even at that age, I was drawn to things that were different, you know. Cedric had us playing all these things that it wasn't simple, it was a challenge, and it was, you know, so I was excited about doing that. But in order for me to play with him in his band, we had to go. He was teaching us Amharic. We had to work out. We had to do all this stuff. We had to learn how to make African clothes. He had a whole little program that we had to do. We literally had to become Africans, you know, to learn this. But I learned a lot there. And the fact that his niece was really cute too, you know, that helped encourage me to go. You know, I was like, oh no, I'm coming around here to play, you know. So that's what I did, you know, and it got me without recognizing what's happening. Because when I went around to Cedric, there were people like Desi Jones, you know, and all these cats. So for whatever reason, without even trying, I just would always end up in the middle of all these great musicians, you know, and I didn't try to. You know, I was friends with Derek Barnett and all these guys that are like legends that, you know, at the time they were just my friends. They were just the cats I played music with, you know, and I was just too young to understand the importance of it, you know. I would play in all these bands, you know. I met Richard Ace. He was educated at the Royal School of Music in England and came back to Jamaica. He knew a lot. And I was jamming amongst him, and because of him, I met the Gladiators. I ended up playing in the Gladiators band. I ended up playing with, they call themselves Psalms now, but back then they were the Gay Lads. You know, so I was playing in all these bands. I played with, you know, all these people, including Kid Us. But I liked hanging out with Kid Us, so I would go, I would rehearse with him. We played Sunsplash together. And then Kitty was the first person that gave me a US $100 bill. And I was like, whoa, what is this? You know? And Kitty took really good care of me. And Kitty, he took this attitude that was different. It was kind of a lot like Cedric. You know, I would leave school, I'd show up at his house. After that, I'd show up at his house with my school bag and my school uniform. And, you know, he would tell me, you need to go to school, you know. And, you know, so he took on this role kind of like a father. And for whatever reason, I just kind of drew to him. And I didn't know what Rockers was at the time, but I was his band, and Rockers was going on tour. So I was the drummer for the Rockers tour. You know, so I left Jamaica to go do.
How old were you during that time?
When I left for the Rockers tour, I must have been like maybe 15. You know, this all happened in my early teenage years. You know, because I remember it was, I think, 1979. The end of 1979 to the early 80s was when I was doing the Rockers tour. And on that tour, the musicians on that tour, again, I didn't realize the company I was keeping. You know, so like we had two keyboardists. One was Touter from Inner Circle, the next one was Tyrone Downey from the Wailers. You know, Ernest Wilson was on bass. We had Gibby, we had Little D, we had, you know, we're all great musicians, you know, and here I was, this kid in the middle of all of this. But one of the groups that I used to play for and I rehearsed with a lot was the Congos, you know, And as the Congo's drummer, we rehearsed continuously. We did a little movie in Jamaica called Image of Africa. You know, they were signed with CBS, and you know, the guys came to Jamaica, did that. So I was in the movie, I was with them, and I was a part of that. I liked their music, and they had these unique falsetto and all the harmonies and all this stuff, and they had me singing that stuff. So for me, it was like, these are the things I wanted to do because, you know, as a kid, I thrived on the challenges and being able to do all these things and sing all these parts. And, you know, so I really liked it. And I rehearsed with them. We rehearsed, I think it was almost like 2 years. But I left because we were rehearsing to go on tour. And I left and went on the Rockers tour with Kitty. And I guess they were looking for me because their tour was ready to start. And by the time the Rockers tour was done, it was time for that tour to get going. So I just went from that tour straight to that the other tour. And I was on tour with the Congos. We ended up in Europe, and when we got to Paris, they had some internal issues. And you know, of course, being a naive young kid just playing music, I had no clue what was going on. I was a kid, you don't ask the grown man them about their business. You know, they say play, you just play, you know. And I was doing all the things that was just heaven to me. I was a little kid from Jamaica, and I'm traveling all over the world doing all this stuff. And they were paying me money that I had nothing to do with my money. And I was saying to someone that to Marsha Ricky, I remember going into this hotel, and I think it was Gramercy Park in New York Hotel or something. And I didn't like the TV they had. And there was this, because when I was walking around Manhattan, I remember seeing this really cool TV, and I wanted to watch that TV, and I had money. I just went and bought this TV and took it into the hotel, and that's what the TV I watched. And when I left, I just left it in there, you know, because I didn't know what to do with money. They were paying me money and all this stuff, but nobody asked what the next person was getting paid, whether it was fear or any of that stuff. We were just making music, you know, and that was the early part of my life, you know, and that's how I came to America, you know. And after the group, they had some issues in I think Paris, we had some issues, and the group kind of broke up there, and they sent us back to New York to regroup and get our stuff together. We were going to put in new members in the band and all this stuff and rehearse and go back on tour to complete the tour. But when we got to New York, they put us in an apartment. They took all our passports, and it just didn't happen. So here we were sitting there in New York. We don't have our passport. We have no tickets, no way to go back to Jamaica, you know. And then guys started leaving. You know, my friends has just started leaving. I didn't know what to do. So I had this friend from Jamaica. His name was Paul Hinton. And most people know him as Computer Paul. And I remember linking with him in New York, calling him and talking to him. He used to come see me. And I was talking to him. Everybody was taking off. And he said to me, "You know what? I have a friend you can come stay with this friend." And this friend was a guy named Wayne Chin. Now, I didn't know Wayne Chin, but Wayne Chin was on the air in Jamaica. And so I knew who he was. And he also had a band called Creole. And I remember watching them out at Tasties. So I knew who he was, but we didn't know each other. And he took me to his house. He had a basement. He was like, "You could stay in the basement," and all this stuff. And here we were in the Bronx, you know, just there trying to figure out how we getting back to Jamaica. No passport, no ticket, no nothing, you know. And then somebody came up with the bright idea of us doing a few studio sessions and a few gigs to make some money, buying a ticket and just making our way back to Jamaica. So that's how we reformed our group, Itopia, and we started hustling. But the studio we used to hustle out of a lot was called Wackies. And we ended up becoming the house band for Wackies. And I stayed at Wackies for, I think, about 8 years, from 1980 to about 88, something like that. And we made all the music that was made there within that time. You know, I met Clive Hunt there. We all became friends. We, you know, Worked there. I did albums there with John Holt, Paragons, Ektones, Ken Boot. I mean, the list is just ridiculous, you know, of the people that we recorded there and of the projects that I ended up getting involved with. And we also were the band that whoever was anybody that was touring, you know, would also use our band to tour the US, you know, because we were the backing band that backed everybody. We were called Itopia. And that's what we did. So we toured with everybody, you
And you
know.
were still not 18 yet.
No, I was still just a kid, you know, doing all that stuff, you know. And there was this guy named Tony Doman. Anthony Doman, and he was out here in LA. And he would fly to New York and get us to record for him at Wacky. So he would hire us to do his recording. Then he would come back here, record his, you know, different artists on the track and release them here. And I remember, you know, he was really cool. Me and him started talking, and he was like, come out to LA, come out to LA. You know, and I'm like, what? I don't know nobody in LA. When you live in New York, you think you can't live anywhere else but New York. You know, it's like, nah, I can't even imagine being anywhere else but New York. I want to go back to Jamaica, you know? So that's, we did that for a while. And I remember this one year he came and he told me he was building a studio and he wanted me to come out and help him build a studio, set up the studio and stuff. And I was going through some changes at the time, you know, with my band and, you know, some other little issues. And I was kind of a little down and disappointed, broken out because I was a teenager, had all these ideals of how life should be, what we should do, and all this stuff. And just even the thought of just working, it was just about money and paying bills was like depressing me. You know, and I was like, okay, I got to get away. So I took his offer and I came out to LA to help him build his studio just to get away from all of that and clear my head. And that's how I ended up in LA. And I was building his studio here, and I started meeting all the people out here, Prince Ital, Joe, Shaka Man. I met Mikey Dread, even though I knew Mikey Dread from before, you know, I just started linking up with all these people out here. And I started recording. I did my first album I did out here was with a group called Boom Shaka with Trevi. And I recorded the Creation album with them, you know, I had them produce it, played a lot of the instruments on it for them and stuff like that. And we did that at the studio that I was building. But the thing about the studio, when I was building the studio, I would test it by recording in there. So if I did something, then I would record something using it to make sure it worked right and everything. So I was recording all these songs, not planning to use any of it or do anything with it, but I was just recording it. It was all these different kind of sound. It was a step away from just my traditional reggae thing that I was doing. And, you know, I had some reggae in there too, yes, but, you know, so that's how I ended up in LA, you know, doing all of that. And just like the rest of the story of my life, things just started, things just happened mystically and magically, you know. I make some of the simplest decisions. I never made any decision from the point of view of this is about money. You know, my whole thing was just about loving what I did, you know, being it. And I remember what my mentor, and a good friend of mine, Gibby, Liebert Morrison, I remember him saying that. He said, you do everything. Anything you can do, just do it and do it to the best of your ability. Because eventually something will break. And when it break, it'll be you. And I just lived by that. If someone came and they had a dollar, I would do the same quality work for them as I would do for somebody who had $1,000 or $10,000. You know?
So not only did you get on the ground, on the job training, excellent, very high level, you must have tremendous discipline in order to stay focused and do that. A lot of people, you know, they say they want to do music and they get involved, but sometimes they get distracted. It seemed that you did not get distracted, that you stayed and you had a lot of mentors around you that must have kind of held you up to keep you away from the distractions, because there's a lot of them.
And to be honest with you, I consider myself very blessed, and very fortunate for just even the friends and all the help and assistance that I had, and just the way things kind of fell together without me even trying. Things just kind of happened. And there were people that
Still on it.
they would say little things, and maybe they would say it in passing, but I would hold on to that thought, and it would shape my life, who I was, every little thing I thought that I could do to improve myself. I remember as a kid in Jamaica, I would listen to this guy. I think his name was E.T. Taylor, something like that. And I would listen to him on the radio, and he would talk about focusing your mind, and he would do these exercises and all this stuff. I wasn't sure what it was, but I tried it. Because I had a problem at night when I would go to lay down to sleep, my brain would just be running like 1,000 miles per hour. I would, I would think through everything that happened in the day, what I did, how I could have done it better, different. And then I started thinking about what's going to happen tomorrow. And I'd go to bed at 11 at night or 12 at night. And next thing I know, it's 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning, just laying there thinking about this stuff. So I realized that I had to do something to calm my mind. So when this guy started talking about being able to focus and, focusing on the light bulb and, all this stuff, I started doing his exercises. And as weird as it seemed, for years I practiced a lot of those same things because once something works, it works, And I had a lot of, I'm not gonna say bad things or, I went through some changes in my life that created certain scars, but I never saw them as scars. They were badges of honor to me, And, like for example, I had abandonment issues because, my mom died so young. I was mad at her. For because she used to always I used to dream about her dying before she died, and she'd be there waking me up in the middle of the night, and she'd rock me and tell me, "Don't worry, I'm not going anywhere, I'm right here." And then she died, and I was mad because she promised me she wouldn't leave me, and those things drove me to a point where I developed certain ways of it within my head without knowing what I was doing that I wanted to live. So I decided instead of me ever feeling that pain of not having that solid foundation or not having my mom or somebody to, so I would adopt families. So if one didn't work out, I got a backup. You know what I'm saying? And I would do that. And I learned how to depend on myself. I started being an engineer because I was in the studio waiting on engineers to come and getting frustrated. And I was just like, let me learn how to do this because I'm tired of waiting on, I'm tired of depending on people. I started learning how to play these different instruments for two reasons. When I wanted it played and how I wanted it played, it was easier for me to just go do it than to try to explain to somebody else how to do it. But I was always the kid where if I'm the drummer, I'd meet drummers. And when the job came, if they need a drummer and a bass player, I would let my friend who played the drum go play drum and I would play the bass. And then I started meeting a lot of bass players, and now they needed somebody to play something else, and I ended up being the engineer. And stuff. And I just always kind of functioned that way where I never just relied on one, but that is a result of my scars. It forced me to go. I never settled or put myself in a situation where, I would find myself in a position. Some musicians, this is all they do. And if they can't do that now, how the hell are they gonna do? I never put myself in that position. And without realizing that's what I was doing, that's what I did. And that together with just understanding how things work and seeing one-on-one meet will eventually lead you to two. And if you double that, you eventually come to four. I could see that, you know what? I remember going to being in Japan and seeing this thing called MIDI, computer music. And everybody was, this is a joke. And rah, rah, rah. I looked at that thing and I was like, I gotta learn that. How does that work? Because to me, that was a means of me not having to call five guys. And that was just all a result of the scars that I had drove me to be this person. I didn't realize none of this until I was like in my 30s. And I started questioning what made me who I was, So I was thinking to myself, me and some of my friends back from the street days, me, Irby, Courtney and all this stuff. And we always marvel because we just have a whole different outlook on life. Even though we grew up around what was going on in Jamaica, none of us gravitated to that. Yeah, we touched on a little thing where, we want to go, you want to do this, do that, you get a little, but we always got focused and came back to what was important. As I said, nobody told us this was beyond us. I remember us going to record for Sir D at Studio One, and he asked us what we wanted, and we were all like, oh, we each want a motorbike. We each want this, because that's how we thought. We just thought big. It's like we didn't realize, the gravity of everything, because nobody was there to tell us, kid, it don't work like this. You can't do this. We saw ourselves playing in the biggest venues. We saw ourselves doing all these things because nobody told us, no, it's baby steps or whatever. So forget baby steps, leaps and bounds. We're gonna go do whatever we needed to do. And we would sit out on the street corner all night and fantasize and dream. And we would talk about music and, all this stuff. And we just sat on the corner doing that. And it was so funny. We were so tight. Like I said, we would follow each other into everything that each other did. Sometime at night, we liked being together so much that sometimes, like, we'd hang out and now, okay, it's the middle of the night, it's 12 o'clock. And then we would all follow one guy home so he would get home safe. But then he would follow us back to take on the next guy. And we'll be in the middle of, it's 3 o'clock in the morning, we're going, what the, what are we doing? That's how we were. And every door I got into, I would pull all my friends with me. And my friends would do the same thing. So if one of us got in the door, we started going, oh, we know a keyboardist, we know a guitarist, we know this and that, and we would just pull each other into it. And because looking back at it, because our chest was so high, as they would say, and we had so much high thought, we didn't feel like Michael Jackson sang better than us. We didn't feel like, Jaco Pastoria could play. Yeah, he has experience, he's got something, but we can learn that. We can do that. We didn't have Stanley Clarke. Okay, yeah, he's dope, but we can play that. And nobody told
You
us.
had no limitations because nobody put that on you. And the school didn't put it on you and say, well, if you want to do this, you have to do this in order to get there. You had none of that, which was probably the best
So
education ever.
that shaped our lives. You know what I'm saying? So it was really all mystical and magical. And I always remember the thing, I try not to live my life with blinders on. Some people, like how they put the blinders on the horse to stay focused. This is where you're going, this is where you're gonna. I never felt like I knew what tomorrow hold or what my life is supposed to be or who I was supposed to be with or who I was supposed to become. I never felt like I knew any of that. I always felt like there was all this stuff that was out there, and I was just looking around. I wanted to see every opportunity. I wanted to follow every lead. I wanted, So some of my biggest breaks came from people who, when they came into my life, my brain was saying, don't mess with this guy. Don't mess with this person. This makes no sense. You're just wasting your time. They're going to rip you off or whatever. But then something else deep inside of me from, embedded from when I was a kid would say to me, so what if you don't get anything out of it? Just help them. People have been helping you your entire life. Just help them. And if you never see them again, it's okay. You know what I'm saying? That was always in my heart. I remember the first time I met Eitel Joe, and he was telling me he wanted me to work with him. And people was telling me he can't sing, he's not a good person, he's this, that, rah, rah, rah. And
Right.
he came up to me, he came up to
Excited, Joe.
me. Yeah, and he came up to me and said, and he was looking at me like, he walked around me as like, I keep hearing about you. People say you and I look on me good looking. And even say things like, and I'm thinking to myself, what the hell? Who's this guy? And then he starts laughing, and then he comes, he's like, yeah, man, I always hear about you, and rah, rah, I shoot my hand. And I just liked him.
Yeah,
I just
definitely
liked
one
him.
of a kind. He had
Yeah, I
a
just
different kind
liked
of
him. Me and
character.
him clicked. And I told Joe, I credit I told Joe with being a key player. You know how in life you come to crossroads, and there's certain events in life that changes your whole direction in life. I told Joe was one of those points for me.
You're
And
bossy.
yeah, he was a trip.
He
And me
was
and him had
bossy.
squared off a few times, but
But
I
he didn't
never.
have no fear. He had no fear, and
Yeah.
he felt there was no door he couldn't walk through no matter what.
Exactly. And maybe that's why me and him connected. And he, at one point, after me producing some songs with him, he made a decision that he ain't voicing no songs unless I voiced him. I was going to be his producer. And I was going to lead his band. So any band he had, he wanted me involved in it. Anytime he was going to sing, he wanted me there. And let me tell you something. Just that mentality opened so many doors for me, because I told Joe he was up there with everybody. He was in the mix,
Everybody.
everybody. And whenever people wanted to record him, the first thing he did is he told them, "If I'll record, but Fabian got to come record me." So I was meeting all these people that he knew.
Royal Safari. Yeah,
Yeah.
that was the name of it. Royal Safari up in Hollywood there.
And all of that happened real mystically. I did not set out to go, oh, I'm gonna be this, I'm gonna do this, I'm gonna go get this job, I wanna meet this person, I wanna, it was never anything like that. I just got up, and a lot of the people that I met, it was right. Some of my dearest friends to today, it's just about that. It has nothing to do with how good you are, how bad you are, whether you have money or not, whether you're black, you're white, and had nothing to do with none of that. I just always remembered that, it's just people are just people. Opportunities are around you every day. The universe provides opportunities for you. If you put on blinders, you're gonna miss half of them or most of them. So that's the way it is. A lot of the things, even me signing with Disney, that was a result, direct result of that, because I was working with these guys. They were a part of that whole Eazy-E camp, and everybody was like, oh, don't work with them. Oh, don't do this. They're gangsters. They're this, that, right? Don't do it. And I met these guys. They were cool. And I was just like, all right, let's do it. And they used to come over to my house and we used to record over there. And there was this one guy that used to come with them all the time. He would just come to the studio and just chill. I never saw him pick up a guitar, a keyboard, a mic, nothing. He would just come. And I always wondered, what's his thing? Why he just come by and hang out? You know, this is the studio was in my home, you know? And I was like, wow. But I always try to humble myself and just, you know, deal with things a certain way. And I move by the spirit, you know, how the spirit tell me to move. One day this guy showed up on my doorstep and he was telling me, you know, he really likes what I do. He wants to manage me. But I just come out of this management situation, you know, and I was like, no, I don't want a manager. I don't, you know, I'm gonna just do my thing. And at that time, I was doing a lot of American music. I was working with a lot of American bands and stuff like that. And he was like, he was trying to convince me to let him. And then the compromise we reached was he said to me, okay, give me 6 months. You don't have to sign any contract. Let me show you what I can do for you. And I was like, okay, 6 months, no contract. Okay, what can I? I was like, okay, go ahead. He said, if I in 6 months I show you that I can do this, then you sign with me for a year. If I
Okay.
right? I said, okay, that's fair enough. If you're putting in the work, you know. And then he goes, and if within that year I can, you know, we're making money, I can show you, I can be a good manager, you sign along a deal with me. Or if you don't want it, then you know, whatever, you know. I
Okay.
said, okay. And within that 6 months, he came and one day he showed up. He was like, come on, take a ride with me. I didn't know where he was going. He took me onto the Disneyland. You know, I went up there, I met the vice president of Disney Music, and we chatted for a while. And I ended up being the first black writer producer they signed.
Wow.
You're talking about Disneyland in Anaheim, not Disney
No, Disney, the
offices.
mother company, the main
Okay, the
company for
main
Disney
company.
that makes all the movies. They own Disneyland. They do, you know, I got signed to them making music for their movies.
Just
And, you
like
know,
in Burbank, is that Burbank?
the same spot you see up there. They own Hollywood Records and all that stuff up there in Burbank. Right on that lot is where he took me. And they have a couple other buildings outside of the lot where their corporate offices and stuff are. And I spent years with them
Wow. What
doing
was your
that.
biggest project that's well known at with the Disney family?
Probably Hakuna Matata, The Lion King.
Lion King.
You know, that I mean, I had songs in a bunch of movies. You know, different movies, Jungle to Jungle. You know, there were a couple of movies that I did some music for with Mark Wahlberg on Universal. And, you know, there was a lot, I can't think of all of them right now, but there are quite a, you know, quite a few movies that I have music in.
And then, oh, in
I did.
that capacity, you have music in, and were you engineering also, or just the music?
Well, at the time they signed me as a songwriter producer. So, I would write songs for the movies, but it wasn't just the movies. There were other projects. They were trying to get into other projects on the street. They were trying to expand their thing. And I was working with Mark Wahlberg at the time, Marky Mark. He, you know, had his street hit. He was a street kid doing his thing or whatever. And I had worked amounts, Ruthless Records, them and Boss Man and Monopoly. So they saw me as I'm in the streets so they can get some publishing on some of this stuff. You know, so they put me to write with all these people, they'd fly me all these places to write with different people and produce stuff. So that's the capacity I was signed in. So yeah, it was with the movies. And the with the movie thing, a lot of times that when I got on projects, it was because the guy that signed me, the vice president at the time, I was like his secret weapon. So there'd be songs that were in movies and he liked the song and the song got scratched out of the movie and he would send it to me and go, Fabian, see what you can do with this. I like the song. I want to put it back in the movie and I'd do a different. And then it would get back in the movie. You know, so that's, you know, So that's kind of the capacity that I work with. I was like his little secret weapon, you know?
And was that from an I Tell Joe connection?
No, the I Tell Joe, like I signed with the Jacksons because of I Tell Joe, because they wanted to do some stuff with I Tell Joe, and he told them he ain't singing nothing unless Fabian is voicing. So he sent for me. I went out to their house in Avonhurst, and I'd be out there working with him and, you know, voicing him. And I ended up billing some tracks for them. And one day Joe Jackson approached me and told me he really liked what I did and he wanted to manage me. So I signed with him and he started managing me. I was a staff producer for the Jacksons, you know, and
Michael included at that time.
well, no, it was the Jackson family. It was,
Okay.
you know, Michael had ATV and he had gotten me a situation with ATV. Because of, I guess, just the family connection, but Michael himself, he was doing his thing, and then the rest of the Jacksons, the Jackson family, you know, he was a part of it, but it wasn't just Michael,
I got you.
no.
He had already broke away.
Right, and he spent most of his time out in Neverland at that time, and you know, so all of those things, you know, I Tell Joe, that happened because of I Tell Joe. The whole Marky Mark situation happened because of I Tell Joe, and a bunch of other little situations that got opened up because, you know, I met them through I Tell Joe. You know, I met Tupac through I Tell Joe, and you know, just, you know, just a lot of that. So I do credit Joe and I had a different kind of relationship. I liked it though. You know, it was very strange, you know. And he liked me. I don't know how many of his other friends, because me and Joe, like I remember us, he's taking his girl and his kid. I'm taking my girl and my kid, and we'd all go to Magic Mountain together and spend the day. We did a lot of things like that. You know what I'm saying? And I remember I used to drive this little car, and he was driving this BMW, this blue BMW, and he just came around and he was just like, "Jed, you what kind of old car that you drive in?" And he just gave me the BMW. You know what I'm saying? So it's a different kind of situation with me and him, you know? And we were really good friends, even though there were times where we wanted to kill each other, you know.
Bring that out of
But
you.
you know, and I always tried to just bring, I'd push him. He liked the fact that I push him, you know, beyond where others would push him. Because when a lot of people would give up and go, "Oh, he's never gonna get it," or whatever, and he'd be mad at me, you know, he'd be like, "Jed, I can't do it." No, but I'm like, "Yeah, man, you can go back in there, you know," whatever. And he'd be mad, but he's like, "All right, you know."
You weren't a part of the Poverty Sucks project, were you?
No, the Poverty Sucks thing. When I came in, he had just done Poverty Sucks, so you know, I wasn't a part of that. No. So, yeah. So, you know, I Tell Joe was the person also that pulled me out of that studio, I and I studio, and took me to that. This is another one of those mystic stories I'll tell you about. I was working in the studio one night, and I Tell Joe, bang, bang, banging on the door. It was I Tell Joe. He came. He was like, "Y'all always coop up in the studio. Y'all always very, come out, man. I'm gonna take you out tonight." I'm like, no, I got work to do." It's like, and he kept insisting, and he's hard to say no to. So I ended up going, "Okay, what the hell?" And I got into this thing, this car, and he took me to a club called Grand Slam. Now, I didn't know what Grand Slam
Oh.
was, but that was Prince's club. And Mikey Dread was performing the night. So Joe took me up into this VIP area, and I'm sitting there with them watching Mikey Dread. And I hear this boom, 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 you know, coming through the walls. So I'm like, "What is that? What is that?" So I've seen Mikey Dread show quite a few times. So I sneak out and I start following this bass, and it led me into this big room. I guess that was the main Grand Slam club. So I went in the club. The club wasn't open yet. It was empty. There was like a group of girls in the center of the floor, and they're dancing and doing all these crazy dances and splits and flipping and doing all this stuff. And the only other person beside myself that was in the club was on the next end of this long bar, was another guy standing there, and he's watching these girls dance just like me. So I see him, we see each other, we kind of give each other a heads up, and we're watching the girls. And these girls would do these flips and all these splits and all these crazy stuff. And every time they do something crazy, me and him would look at each other and shake our heads, like, yeah, you know? I don't know, remember exactly how it happened, but somehow we found our way in the middle of the bar together, me and him talking. And we're talking about these girls and whatever. And the girls started leaving one by one. And I remember him saying to me he was going to go smoke a cigarette out on the balcony. And he said, come on, let's go. Now, I don't smoke and I don't really hang out around people who smoke cigarettes. So normally I would say no. But for whatever reason, I don't even know why, I just said, all right, it's outdoors. You know, if it's getting too much, I'll just leave. And I went out there with this guy. And we're out there talking about all kind of foolishness. We're just shooting the breeze, nothing important. And then after he put out his cigarette, we're getting ready to go. And he said, what do you do? I said, oh, I'm in music. And he said, yeah, my family is in music too. And whatever. I'm like, okay. And he's like, you know, you should come on in with me. I'm gonna introduce you to some folks. And I was like, okay. So I go back in and he takes me back into the same Mikey Dread concert. So I'm thinking to myself, I first walk in here, okay, you know, Mikey Dread, he's going to do the Mikey Dread or whatever. I don't know. But anyway, we sat at this big table and there's all these people and he introduces me. This is my friend Fabian, whatever. And I was like, yeah, and everybody shaking my hand, saying hi. And then somebody comes and whispers something in his ears. And he says to me, I'll be right back. And he gets up. And would you believe I never saw that guy again? But the fact that he brought me to that table and sat me down, everybody around the table started looking at me, going, so how do you know Rockwell? How do you know? I didn't know who he was.
Wow.
And they were like, and they're like, what do you do? And I'm like, I do music. Oh, I want to hear your music, whatever. And they start handing me their cards. And I'm looking at these cards, and it's all director of black music at CBS, or so, you know, this person from Sony.
Wow.
And there was a bunch of Motown people there, and director of black music, Motown, this, that, blah, Motown. And I'm seeing, and I'm like, this is unreal. So I have a stack of cards now. And they're like, oh, yeah, give me a call. Make sure you give me a call, you know, whatever. So I'm thinking to myself, this can't be real. So I remember getting up the next day and calling the first card. And it was actually CBS. And the guy, you know, is like, I want you to come up, you know, come on, meet with me. I want to hear your music and all this stuff. He's like, I'm gonna give you an appointment. And he gave me an appointment for like a few days, you know, for it. So I'm like, wow. So I said, let me call another one. And I called this guy, Motown. And he's like, oh, yeah, I remember you. He's like, yeah, you know, I want to hear your music. And I was like, yeah, when you want to set it up for me to come. He's like, what are you doing? Come up now. And I was like, why? He's like, yeah, just come up here now. And he gave me the address. I went up in the Motown building and I sat down with him and I started playing in my little cassette that I was recording over at I&I. And I'm playing him all this stuff, and he's like, oh, this is good. You know, who's producing this? I'm like, me, I'm not a producer, I'm the producer. I'm just me. He's like, oh, that's cool. What musicians? And I'm like, oh, that's just me. And when he realized I was singing and playing and recording and doing everything myself, he's like, wow, who's your manager? I said, I don't have a manager. And he goes, well, all right, you got a manager now. He's like, I'm your manager. And he gave me some
Wow.
money and gave me a little contract to sign. And he's like, you have a development deal here with Motown and blah, blah, blah. And what I was like, okay. And just mystically, just like that, it happened. I remember him calling him up and, you know, he's like, he started introducing me to all these producers and all these, you know, musicians and people in the R&B and pop industry. And I was just like, wow, I felt like I wasn't even ready for all of that, but he was just introducing me to all these people. And I remember it introducing me to Jody Watley's boyfriend, was a big producer
Oh.
guy. And they had that song out, I'm looking for a new love. And he introduced me to him. And he also introduced me to another guy named Julian Jackson. And I remember meeting with them. They were going to produce my thing and all this stuff. And I called Robert up one day and I didn't get him. And I kept calling and calling. And for about almost a week, I couldn't get him on the phone. So I went to meet Julian because we were supposed to do some recording together. And I said to him, I haven't been able to reach Robert for like a week. And he said, oh, Robert's in jail. And I was like, what? Oh, you mean he's in jail? He's like, yeah, he got caught with some cocaine or something or whatever. And he's like, but you don't need to be with those guys anyway. Come hang with us. We'll take care of you kind of vibe, And I was like, okay. And I started working for him. And he would send me out to produce people, because they were connected with everybody. And I started meeting a whole lot of set of people through them. And but things just happen mystically, just like that, all the time. I get up one day, I'm not trying to accomplish anything or make any headways, and the doors just open simply because I did just close them and say no. And I could sit here all night and tell you story after story after story that's just like that. And it's just been the story of my life. It's just mystical how it happens, And that's just how it is, And it's like even I'm doing a lot of TV now and movie stuff, and it's a real similar situation how it happened. I was doing a session with Junior Toots, and he used to bring this guy with him. And this guy used to always come. And one day the guy showed up by himself and he said to me, oh, he's working on a TV show. And he wanted me to help him make the music for the TV show. And while we were there working, he brought his partner. I didn't know who these guys were, but these guys were major players in the whole thing. And I was listening to them talk. They just did this deal with TV One to produce a show, and the show was finished. Everything was done. Their partner was Raphael Siddiq, and for whatever reason, Universal decided that all of Raphael Siddiq's music is going to come out of the shows. So they were sitting in my studio talking about what they were, how were they, what are they going to do? And I just kind of said to them, well, guess what? I've always wanted to do TV. So I make a deal with you. You bring me one of the shows, I'll show you what I can do. You like it, you put me on. You don't like it, you don't owe me anything. They brought me two shows. I did the two shows and I didn't hear nothing from them for like maybe like a little over a week, almost 2 weeks. I didn't hear nothing from them. And I thought, okay, I guess they didn't like it. Then they showed up and brought all the shows. And we've been
What were the
rocking.
shows?
It was a show called a TV thing called Love That Girl, starring Tatiana Ali, the little girl
From Bill Cosby.
from
Fresh
Fresh
Prince.
Prince, right?
Fresh Prince, yeah.
And that was the first project we did together, and we've been rocking together for over 13 years now.
Wow.
I do all their music, I do all their shows. I have, at first I was just doing the music, then it got to I'm doing all the sound. And I was mixing the shows, and I ended up writing some shows, directing some shows, shooting the shows. And we've just been rocking since, and a lot of great things have happened, since then,
At what point did you cross Eddie Murphy's path?
Well, Eddie Murphy, the same guy I told you about. That I met him and Eddie Murphy, I guess they kind of grew up together. He's one of Eddie's best friends. And he came to me one day and said, Eddie wants to make some reggae music. I told him about you, he wants to meet you. And he took me up to Eddie's house. And we ended up recording a ton of music, all kinds of stuff. And that's where Red Light came out of.
I like Red Light. I was going to
They just
ask you.
released it to the net. They just released it to the net. And like, and one day I looked up and it was like 7 million views. And I was like, wow. And next time I turned up, it was 15 million views. And then I was watching Eddie on I think he was on the Ellen DeGeneres show. And she was saying that it had something like 30 million views or something like that. This
30
is
million.
million views.
Oh, wow.
Some crazy amount of numbers. It was crazy. And I started hearing about it showing up in the chart. It wasn't even in the charts in Jamaica. And it was just, Eddie comes in, he starts singing something on his guitar. I start figuring out a bass line and we just put it together. I would play some keyboards, I'd play some guitar, play some bass, do this, that, And we did one song, everybody loved it, and he wanted to do another one. He kept calling, and that went on for several years. And together, I don't know how many songs are that, but it's easily probably upward of 30 something songs we've recorded together, And he started taking some of his old songs that he did before. I was like, let's redo this in reggae,
Is
And
that does that when Snoop walked into it at that time too?
well, Snoop came in after we did it, and I guess Snoop heard it and was like, oh, he wants to be on it and whatever, And they did a we did a little it wasn't even officially a music video because I was still touring with Ziggy at the time, and Trent brought some people in the studio and some camera guys, and they just shot us around the studio playing and doing some stuff, and that's the first video. But it started getting so big, they decided they wanted to do a more official video. But I, me and Santa, because Santa came and played percussion on it for me, And me and Santa was out on the road with Ziggy. And they were like, okay, so they just got some guys to put in a second video. But yeah, the first one that me and Santa is, that was the first video. Those were the people, the keyboardists on there, the singers, all those people. Those are the people who actually played on the record. We were just in the studio and they were just shooting some stuff,
So I know we've had you talking for quite some time and we haven't played any music at all. So I'm going to ask Rashiki if he could key up Red Light. So at least we can get just a little flavor of just a teeny little inkling of what you do.
Okay. There's some really cool, to be honest with you, that was one of my least favorite
Least favorite. Oh my God. What's your favorite?
on the project, But I guess, that just goes to show you never know what's gonna be a hit. But of course it's Eddie Murphy. Anything he does is gonna be a hit, But we have like these songs with all these people. He even has a song with him and Beanie Man, and I love that song,
What's the
And
name of that song?
what's that one called? That one is called One of These Nights. But it hasn't been released. And yeah, it's, projects like that, it's fun,
Did you do any work with Tupac?
No, not officially, no. I mean, he came and jammed with us on stage, but we didn't do no studio work like that, no.
You got a chance to do some traveling. We didn't really talk about it, going to different places. Who were you touring with when you traveled through Europe and Africa? This was like, I
Well,
guess, before you really hit California or after?
I've been touring, like I said, since I was a teenager. So I've done a lot of toured a lot of different people. I've toured with like the Congos, my first tour was that Rockers tour. Between then, I've toured with Big Ute, I've toured with Sugar Minott, I've toured with Eptones. I mean, the list to remember everybody now is crazy. Go moving forward, I've toured with Tina Marie, I've toured with Marky Mark, that whole thing. I've toured with I toured with Steel Pulse, did Africa and a US tour with them. Toured with I spent quite a few years with Ziggy Marley, touring with him. I'm trying to remember Barrington Levy, done some touring with Barrington Levy. I'm just trying to think of which ones come to mind, but Ika Mouse, Wailing Souls, there's a lot of there's so many people, honestly.
Did
Mike Dread.
you tour with Jimmy Cliff also?
No, Jimmy and I worked in the studio. I produced that his version of Hakuna Matata, and Jimmy's also, I found out later, Jimmy's also my cousin. Yeah, I found that out much later, and this is after Jimmy and I even started working together. I was supposed to go see my uncle up at King's House, and I stopped to see Jimmy, because he lives off Lady Musgrave Road, which is on the way up to King's House. And I stopped to see Jimmy, and it made me a little late getting to my uncle at the Governor General's office. So when I went in, and he said, "You're late," and I said, "Yeah, I stopped and saw Jimmy. I had to go see Jimmy Cliff or something like that." And he was like, "Jimmy Cliff, that's your cousin." And I was like, "What?" And he's like, "Yeah." He said, "That's your cousin." I'm like, "Are you serious?" So the next time I saw Jimmy, I said to Jimmy, "You related to the governor, because he's telling me that, we're cousins on." And Jimmy said, "Yeah." He said, "Yeah, here we are." And I was like, "Wow." And nobody said nothing to me the whole time.
Small world.
Yeah.
When you did the was it Hakuna Matata? That was part of Disney.
Yeah.
Was
Yeah,
that
we did that for this.
a big hit or anything, or just the kids were liking Lion King?
Well, obviously it was a major hit with the kids because of the movie and stuff. But the version I did with Jimmy also spent like a lot, I don't remember exactly how many, spent a lot of time at number one on the Billboard charts. It was doing really, really well. And they saw a lot of success with that too, That had came with its own set of challenges. But again, as I said, my whole thing was, I live by that philosophy of just do everything, do it to the best of your ability, and we'll see. And sometimes I got involved with in some situations where, the devil comes, people come in, "Don't work with these people, don't work with that. You get some of that in your ears. Oh, they're gangsters, they're not good people," and whatever. But then I've always been fortunate to just have the right angel on my shoulder to just come and say, "Forget about them. Just go do your work, Fabian." One of the people, there's a gentleman by the name of Danny Sims.
Oh, yes.
And the He was the first person to sign Bob Marley. This is before even Chris Blackwell, them and those guys. And he signed, he owned a lot of Bob Marley's publishing and stuff. And,
That's a tad
he
legend.
also, yeah, he, yeah, and he also managed Jimmy and so forth. So I remember when,
Oh.
I remember I got a call to work on this Bob Marley album. And everybody was telling me, oh no, Danny, he's like a notorious gangster. He's this, he's that. Don't mess with those guys or whatever. And because I know he used to work with Jimmy, I called Jimmy and Jimmy is like, psh, don't listen to them. He's a good guy. He's like, yeah, he ain't no pushover, but he's a good guy, And honestly, that was such a beautiful experience meeting him, and working with him. And doing that Bob Marley project with him. And through that Bob Marley project, I remember him bringing all the Marley boys. The only one that didn't come to the studio was Ziggy at the time, but we all sat there and worked on it together,
And
and
what was the name of that project?
it was called Bob Marley, the Formative Years, Formative year was all of, all them early stuff. And my job basically is back in the day, I guess because he had the deal Bob had with him was as a writer. Bob would play his guitar, him and Peter and Bunny, you'd hear them, playing their guitar and they would sing songs. And they would turn these songs into Danny for approval. So Danny had all these tapes of them writing these songs, singing these songs. There were all these songs that weren't popular. People didn't really know them and stuff. And he had all these tapes of all these early Bob Marley songs. And my job was to remove all the noise, all the music, and all this stuff and turn them into songs. So I had the technology. Like I said, I was always into technology where I figured out how to, isolate Bob's voice and all this stuff. But sometimes all we got was a verse and a hook. And we had to turn that into a whole song. So, that was part of the whole thing, So sometimes we had no ad libs and all this that stuff. And don't, this is a trade secret. Shh. But some of the ad libs on that album were some of the boys that were singing it. Steven, and stuff, they would come in and we would make that, and it was great. And Steven and I ended up being friends as a result of that. And that was the first. And then later on, Ziggy did. And then later on, Ziggy did a kids album where he took a lot of Bob songs and made it called Bees for Bob, and I worked with him on that too. And there are a couple other little things, but that's those were the two main Bob Marley projects that I worked on.
Wow, so you would just come and put your magic on. All the years of you hanging, all the experiences that you had with your brethren, you guys just doing what you wanted, nobody telling you, not putting no limitations on it, following what felt good and was fun, took you to where you are now.
Yeah, basically. And we're still evolving and growing and discovering every day and looking to all the different windows that come every day still for blessings and opportunities to just do what we do,
Did you ever work with Joe Higgs?
I know Joe Higgs. I met him and we did a few things live, but we never worked in the studio together. We never did any studio thing,
What about Ross Michael?
Ras, Michael, and I, we're friends, and we did most of the work I did with Ras, Michael. I did through Steve Verhalt. Steve did a few projects with him, and I helped him with that. And I've done little things here and there with Ras, I think we did some live things too, you know. But I've never done a project with him like that, you
Well,
know.
I have a question.
Yes.
On Peter's side, did you work on that song, Graduation into Zion?
I'm trying to remember. I played a bunch of songs for Kitty, but when I linked up with Kitty, I already had a bunch of songs.
Well, I
So,
know that one was in the movie, Rockers. That song was in the movie.
okay, so I probably did not work on that.
Okay.
More likely I didn't work on that because when I started working with him was when they were actually working on Rockers. You know, and I was just a part of his band. We performed live and do, you know, this is what we did.
That was
So,
one of my favorites.
yeah.
Situation in Zion.
Yeah. Kitty is a really good guy, man. You know, those guys, it's interesting because as old as I am, I see them now and they still treat me like, you know, I'm the little teenage kid. Yeah, you know, especially like Cedric Maiten from the Congas. You know, every time I see him, he still treat me like, you know, I'm the little kid and I love it, you know. You know, those are the guys that, you know, those are the people that mold me and shaped me and, you know, taught me about music and life, you know, because like I said, you know, yeah, I have three brothers and I have a sister, but my family was my musical family. They were the ones I spent on. Even to this day, my friends, you know, guys like Santa and Steve and, you know, Courtney, you know, those are the people I consider family. You know, some saying those are the guys where, you know, if they need blood tomorrow, I ain't even, you know, I'm not even asking how much, you know. These are my friends, you know, and my family. You know, we go on tour together, we work together, but when we come home from tour, we spend our whole time on chatting online or on the phone, or you know, we go to each other's house, help each other with projects and you know, stuff like that. And that's just the way it is, you know. So that's the family, you know. And you have extended family too, but those are my immediate close family, you know.
So you've mentioned a lot of brethren. You know, work with the sister and them too.
Yeah, I've worked with quite a few sisters, in many different capacities. You know, like I said, I've toured with quite a few of them. I wrote a song for Marcia Griffiths that is on Penthouse called Childish Games. You know, my oldest daughter's mom, Annette Brissett, out of Florida, her first album I produced. That whole project with her, you know, she later ended up with, you know, with Sly and Robbie Them Taxi. And there's, you know, I've done a lot of works with a lot of, you know, and I still have females that I work with now to today, you know. But you know, in the reggae business, it's tough for the females. I do notice this new crop of females that is springing up, and I'm so proud of them, you know, for what they're doing. You know, I hope they remember people like Marcia and Judy and so forth who paved the way for them to do that. But I know Tommy Cohen has a daughter there. There's
Oh,
Lila
Naomi.
Aiki. There's just so many of them, and they're doing great work, you know. You know, even within the DJ thing, you know, I'm seeing more where once upon a time it was just a lady star or a sister Nancy or this. Now I'm seeing them cropping up all over the place. You know, so you know, we love the sisters, you know.
Yeah, but we haven't opened up for anyone to ask any questions. We've just been having you talk this whole time. Does anybody online wish to ask any question of Mr. Fabian? And if not, Rashiki, you have another song ready? Okay, I sent.
Yes, I have one.
Okay.
Which one is this? Blaze Bob?
Surprise. Yes. Yeah, boom, boom.
Was that a
Yes.
pun that you worked on, Fabian?
I didn't do that one alone. I
Mm-hmm.
worked with my job was mainly to clean up the vocals, remove a lot of the other stuff from it, you know. It was a collaborative effort, you know. To get a lot of, oh, I see Jesse. Bless up, bless up, bless up. Yeah, so yeah, I mean, we worked on all the songs on the album as far as just, you know, getting the voices, cleaning them up, preparing them, pitching them, doing different things to just kind of help make it work, you know. The concept was to try and keep that old, you know, as I said, the formative years, you know, to keep that kind of sound about it. We did do a couple of remixes of, you know, we flipped it, put some hip hop kind of vibes to it too. We did do a couple of remixes like that. Those, you know, I'm even more involved with. Like songs like Splish for My Splash and, you know, stuff like that. You know, so the songs that most people don't even know, you know.
Can you talk a little bit more about your project with Harvest Studios and what you all are now doing?
Okay. So Harvest Studios is a TV production house. We started out basically where we would just develop content for major networks. You know, we've done projects. We have projects on Fox, projects on TV One, Bounce TV, you know, All Black, you know, Netflix, Amazon. You know, our products are on a lot of these platforms. So that's where we started out, but. And Harvest Studios, that's mainly what we did for many years. What we're growing into right now is Harvest Studios has started their own network called National Black Television, NBTme.net. And so basically, what it is it's our own channel. We're the ones making the content. We're not going to nobody, trying to get nobody to fund nor authorization from nobody to do anything. We're just making our own TV movies and sitcoms and talk shows and cooking shows and workout shows and doctor shows. Just whatever you would see on any network, you know, news, sports, all that stuff. We're doing all of that. It's really an international, it's called NBT means National Black Television, right? It's not really a Caribbean channel, but we are in the Caribbean. So we're starting to develop more Caribbean content because my vision as the Caribbean in the crew is to bring the Caribbean to mainstream. You understand what I'm saying? That's what I would love to do. We are on TV in the Caribbean because we're on Flow, which is cable and wireless's cable network, and we are on Digicel. So we're on the two largest networks throughout the, so if you have a television and you get any kind of internet, cell phone, cable, anything like that, we're on your device, NBT can also be found online at nbtme.net, and there's a whole it's a whole network that just like Tubi or Freebie or Amazon. If you go there, there are movies, you can watch movies. A lot of it right now are our own TV shows and movies, but it's growing and we're starting to add other things from other developers on there. We're also across America over the air. And the last time I was told it was like 80 something urban areas from Miami, Fort Lauderdale, Atlanta, New York, LA. I mean, the list is just ridiculous. Over the air, where all you need to get it is a antenna, rabbit ear antenna. You get us just like how you get Fox and ABC and NBC and all this, so you can just get us, We're also in conversation with a couple of major cable distributors to come to their cable network. You can find us on Apple TV, Amazon Fire Stick, in the Apple, our app is in the Apple Store, the Google Store. I mean, we're just everywhere, and it's gonna just keep growing, we're talking to people in across the whole globe, Africa, Canada, all over the place, to bring it to all these different areas. This is not something that, yeah, that's it there. This is not something that we're just talking about or we're planning on doing. It's actually up and running and it's working. And what we need to do is just make more content and get the word out to people that it's there, So, yeah. That's what we're doing with Harvest. Harvest is the actual studio. NBT is the network and the channel. There's a second network that's coming that's going to be more like a black CNN, mostly news. That's in the makings too, But this is, movies, TVs, all this stuff, So that's what we're doing. We can, just like when you build your own recording studio in the middle of the night. You dream up a song, you go and you record it, you mix it, you finish it, and you can get it out there. But instead of having to take it to somebody and hope they like it and decide to put it out, we can put out whatever we want. Get it out there. We ain't gonna talk to nobody about nothing, and just make it happen. So that is NBT. It's gonna, we're hoping it will turn, well, it is going to turn into the Caribbean network. Because nobody is bringing, the China man them have them channel, the Middle Eastern man them have them channel, and everybody have them, the Korean channel, the Chinese channel, the African channel, all of this stuff. The Caribbean don't really have a channel. So if I have my way, this will be the channel that brings the Caribbean to the entire world. Everything, Sunday morning, you can come watch your favorite service, from the Caribbean. Whatever church, in the middle of the night, you can go on our version of QVC and buy some Caribbean goods from some of the Caribbean people down there. And, so that's some of the vision, and we're bringing it to reality. We're developing content every day.
And is the content specifically geared towards the Caribbean or is
Well,
varied?
it Well, no, it's most of the content that's there now is not geared towards the Caribbean. It's more geared towards
Black.
black people in general. But we do have some content that's geared towards not just the Caribbean, but mostly the diaspora. So all the Caribbeans that live on the East Coast. We want this to be the channel where when they come home from work, if you live in Utah or Chicago or, wherever. You can come home and turn it on and see what the sports setting are, or the political results are, or what's going on back in your country, because you can check out the news, you can check out the sports results. We want to bring all the boxers and footballers and cricketers and all these people who are in the Caribbean, just like how you have HBO Sports and HBO Boxing and Showtime Boxing and whatever. We're going to bring all the Caribbean sports to the United States and the internet and else, worldwide, That is our wish, our vision, and what we're trying to do, But, we're just moving slowly, making sure we do it right and, get a solid hold in there,
And is this something that, people, if they want to be able to have access to it, they'll pay some joining fee or something?
The online service. The online service do have a paid option. I am not that much involved with the paid option, so I can't tell
No,
you
that was just a
everything.
question. I was not
Right.
expecting you to know that, but I just wondered.
Right.
I mean, I know if you have access to YouTube, we could pull it up on YouTube. A lot of things we
Right.
don't have to pay
And
for on
like
YouTube.
I said, in the Caribbean, if you have Flow as your network or Digicel as your network, you can watch our channel for free. And if you can't find it, you can always go to the same site you see or NBTme.net
Me.net.
and watch all the shows. We have a live streaming thing where you can just watch it just like regular TV. You can go in the app store, download the app and watch it,
Then is this app going to be, or the icon available on televisions that are being sold soon? Like,
Yes. Just like how, that's something we're working on right now. Just like, you buy a new TV and you see, the YouTube and the Netflix and the Amazon app already up there. Our app is going to be right up there with them. That's all stuff we're working on right now.
So
And
it's
it's
NBT me.
dot
No.
NBT Me as a National Black Television Me and dot net.
And you'll be including possibly programming from other Caribbean islands, not just.
All as much Caribbean islands are because even though, yeah, I am Jamaican and we have, we love Jamaica, this is something for all Caribbeans.
Nice. Oh, thanks a lot. I see it now. Thanks.
Whether you're Trinidadian, Saint Lucian, whoever,
Yeah,
come from
especially now with
Martinique,
Bad
Saint,
Bunny.
huh?
I said, especially now with Bad Bunny
Yeah.
making such a big. Yeah, man, he's got followers. Oh my
Yes, he
gosh.
does. Billions. Billions.
Really big.
So that's a pretty revolutionary project there. I say congratulations on that. That's one of the things that I think, when we had BET, the one thing we didn't have was news. You could have entertainment up the yin yang, but we're not giving you no news. I mean, that's how they handled it.
Right. And this is all the brainchild of Trenton Gumps, which is one of the gentlemen that started. Remember I told you about those two gentlemen that had the project and they brought me in, it's him and Bentley Kyle Evans. Bentley is well known in the industry as a writer, director, showrunner. He's responsible. He's one of the people who brought us the Martin Show, the Jamie Foxx Show, and tons of other shows. So he's known and respected. And I was fortunate to link with these guys, and we've been rocking since. And it's not always easy when when you're the boss, you have to make sure you keep the lights on. You got to make sure everybody eats and all this stuff. So it's not always just a cakewalk, but I'm fortunate to hook up with these guys, especially Trent, where, him and I have similar vision. We just don't, in nobody told us we can't do it.
That's it.
Oh,
You know
almost
what I'm
back
saying?
to your young manhood of business.
Right.
Full circle, eh?
Yes,
Yeah.
yes.
That's
So,
the fun.
and all I'm gonna say that we're starting to wind it down. Is there anything you just left us with something that, but is there anything that you would like to say, leave, or share before we turn off? And does anybody have any questions that they would like to ask?
Can you guys hear me?
Yes, we can.
Yes.
Okay. Good night to everybody on the panel.
Nice up.
Yeah, man. And
Night.
Fabian Cook, I just want to say it was a pleasure listening to your history, man. You blow me away with all the stuff you did. I know you've done a lot of work, but wow, that's a
Yeah.
lot of work, man, you
Yeah.
know? And especially since you start young, so it remind me of me and my brother. So I see where the combination came in, where how you look at us and how we look on you. I see the vibe, isn't it? It's
Vibe,
a,
respect.
yes. So enough respect, and yeah, man, it was a pleasure listening to all this history, you know? Yeah, man.
And for who don't know, you know, Blaze Mob and I have done some work together too, you know.
Yeah,
This
oh, it
probably
was a
first
pleasure.
album.
Yeah, man. Yeah, man, our
Very
first album we put out to the people, More Consciousness. Yeah, man, it was a pleasure working with Fabian, and you know, like work go with Daddy also right there. It was a learning experience. Me and my brothers, we cherish that, and then we also use it to work on the next album, where it's carved in stone. So, like you, everything you learn and you incorporate it more and more. So we just learn from the eye and just keep incorporating, and like you said, learn more and more and more. So it was
right.
a pleasure listening to all going tonight, man. It was a learning experience for sure.
Yeah, man, respect, man.
Yeah,
Bless.
man, respect, man. I love seeing me. So may I go on and listen? May I go on and listen?
Wow. I was looking at that picture they had up of your face. You look so young.
It's 2000, was that
Like,
2007? That's a long time ago.
it's a long time ago, man. Wow.
Anyone else have any questions? Comments? You're muted. You're muted.
I'd like to say that for me personally, my sons working with Fabian was a dream come true. I remember going to Fabian's studio and giving him a business card that he gave me years ago when they was in diapers. I said, "Oh, put it in my pocket." I said, "Your mama soon come." You remember that night, Fabian?
Yeah, I remember you come check me and I tell you know, say you have the youth them, but them energy and them vibe was just so right, you know. You know, it was something different, it was fresh.
Yeah, it was a blessing. It's a
Yeah,
blessing for
man.
you to work with my sons, and my husband's still there, but I will never,
Yeah.
ever, ever
And
forget
you don't
you.
know got your family too, so you know. So it's automatic family. So there's nothing but a word, you know, anything you need, you know. So
Rastafari. Wow.
I said go, you know.
So there's still 10 people on the panel. You can go and ask each one. Rashiki, if someone wants to say something.
Stevie's unmuted. Hey, Stevie.
Hey, what's up, man?
Come forward, Stevie.
I've enjoyed the video or the interview as long as I've known Fabian, which is many decades. I learned some stuff tonight that I did not know.
Wow.
But definitely, I have had the pleasure to work with him myself. He's super talented, multi-talented, multi-instrumentalist, you know, jack of all trades, and always willing to lend a hand and help musicians get their projects done. And So yeah, nothing but mad respect.
And
Right. Wow.
Steve and I know each other from before. None of us have gray hair. Long time ago.
Yep.
Boy.
I think I've Steve, was it that sugar miner tour you're telling me we met on, right? In Texas?
Yeah, Houston, Texas. You were Itopia was back in Sugar back then in Houston.
Yeah.
I don't know which club is either Fritz Pub House or Club Carabana. It was one of the two. Long time.
Yeah, man, it's a long, long time.
Man, years, man.
Yeah.
Damn
Yes.
near 50 years.
I forgot I told Joe's name because Joe was the first person I met when I moved to California. And he goes, Stiff, you're going to be my blood clot guitarist. Yeah, wicked guitarist. And Joe and I had a lot of, just like maybe it's a lot of crazy experiences with I told Joe. So, but he touched a lot of lives and we miss him dearly.
Yeah, he was a character. He was so sure of himself, man.
Not lack confidence at all. Not at all.
At all.
You
And
know,
he had those.
it's interesting the people we meet along the way and how they affect us, you know, because my mind run on Trevi. I don't know if you remember Trevi, the lead singer
Yes,
of Iron Maiden.
man. Of course.
You know, he was another person that, you know, though I can't think of to say, you know, he connected me with certain people, but just his vibe, his energy, his spirit, you know, just the way he approached things and music, you know, he was a real brethren. And I felt like, you know, that's a connection that helped mold and shape me too.
You
You
could
know,
add
so
the Swellele name to that.
yes, Swelele was another one,
Whoa,
definitely.
whoa, 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 whoa. I love Swellele. Great writer. Excellent
And
lyricist.
what a lot of people, I don't know if everybody knows this, but these names, as weird as Ika Mouse and those guys are, you know, these are the names that create this large reggae market that we know out here now that they call in this Cali reggae thing. We were the ones in the trenches. Yes, I'm saying driving hours, shopping in some little van and car, trying to
Maybe
make it happen.
a
And
true, a true.
my first Bob Marley day was with Henry Thomas at Jackie
Yeah.
Robinson Stadium over off of Rodeo, right there by the jungle.
Yeah.
Whoa.
Baseball diamond with about 30 people in the audience. That was my first Bob Marley day. That was like the second or third one or something.
Yeah, a lot of these people don't realize that the reggae Cali scene, you know, it really started with the surfers. You know, this was this whole, you know, the surf companies were the ones sponsoring it and keeping the reggae concerts. And you know what I'm saying? It was great, man. It's like, and now I watch and I see how many thousands and thousands of people coming out to these festivals, you know. The first one that on that level was the Bob Marley Day.
That's
That was
right.
the, you know,
That
and just made
company
it.
Blackfly did a lot of stuff with us.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting, and we were the little band up there backing everybody, you
Back
know.
in everybody. We're talking
Yeah.
Bob Marley Day from MacArthur's Park.
All of
Move
that, man.
over to the veterans in
Yeah,
West
even it was in
Hollywood.
Culver City. You remember it was in Culver City too?
Yeah, the
Yes,
auditorium.
yes.
Yeah.
Baby and I were doing also the UCLA Reggae
Yeah.
Festival every year.
Yeah,
When we started that, it
we
was
started
free.
doing that. We were the ones that started out all of that. The first
It
of
was
the
free
first
for a
ones.
couple of years, then it went to $1, then it went to $3, but
Right.
we were done. It was over $100 for a ticket.
Bomboras.
Yeah, man, this whole system, the whole Cali reggae system, we, you know, we're the ones that pulled all those fans in, you know, and built it, you know. When I go to, I remember even going down to San Diego and seeing some of the guys, and it's like these guys that they're singing some of our old songs, and you know, they're telling me, oh, they were watching us for all these years, you know. And it's interesting that because you do these things and you don't even give too much thought to the long-term effect, and what the fruits of these labors will be, Mikey Dread, God bless his soul, he put in so much work in this. You know what I'm saying? The only other one I can think of outside of our camp was probably like Pato Banton was another one that did, put in a lot of work too, but those were the
He's
guys.
still putting in the work.
Yeah, the little strands, and I remember there was a little place on in Venice on Lincoln Boulevard. You had to walk up those steps,
Blue Lagoon.
Blue Lagoon, and all these
Blue Lagoon.
Kinston 12, all these little
Oh,
places,
yes. No,
Music
the
Machine.
Music Machine, all of these,
Yes.
people. We're telling our age now, but.
Say on behalf of female singers, Fabian, I met you many years ago. You were excellent then. I knew you were going places. And we had well, I was with Bamiki Bandula. We had Women in Reggae. I was with Shuba, which was Henry Thomas's group. And then we did background with Trevi's creation and some other stuff, me and Aziz. So, yeah, you.
I remember what's that? Joe had a girl too that she's
Lori. Lori.
Lori.
Lori.
I don't know whatever happened to her, but
Lori's married
Lori
and
Harris, she's still
living in
singing now.
Arkansas. She's still
Yeah.
singing.
Okay, beautiful, man.
Did you,
Beautiful.
Fabian, did you work with Ivy Love?
Yes, I know Irie Love. Yeah.
Yeah.
In fact, I just saw her. I just saw her at the Grammy party thing that they threw here the other day. Just first time in many, many years, Yeah, she still looked the same, still doing her thing.
Yeah, man.
No. It's a lot. It's a lot, I remember when we used to go to Vegas, there was nothing out there. We used to
Right?
go to with Rankin Skrew and Ginger and this other guy that used to play the Steel Pants. What's
Wayne
his name?
Stein or
Yeah.
somebody else? Einstein or someone?
Einstein, yeah, Einstein. And we used to go up there, man. It's just a lot. I remember when Hawaii, we used to go over to Hawaii and do concerts and stuff and just to
Yes.
watch and see where it is now. I remember J Boog and those guys when they were just these little youngsters trying to, make it
At the
happen.
Lighthouse with
Yeah.
Detour Posse, right?
I remember doing this concert with J Boog down in Compton and stuff, and when after I started touring with him again later, he came to me and said, "You remember me?" I was like, "Of course I remember you." And but it's just so long, it goes back so far. I look at guys like Common Kings,
Yes.
before they were Common Kings, they were Natu Soul,
Cypress Hill.
and I used to produce them.
Wow.
Started them out, yeah, way back.
So,
So,
Spavery, you ever been on the Jamrock Cruise?
no, I've never been a Jambox crew, but I am booked to go to the next one.
Yeah, tell you,
I'm
man, that come like Christmas. I really needed that cruise. It
yeah,
was a healing for me.
I was supposed to go before and I didn't make it, just too much to do. But I'm supposed to be working the next one with Barrington Levy.
Okay.
Me and Steve.
Yes, sir. We'll
We'll
If
see,
you
the one you're on the cruise, them say, if you snooze, you lose. You have to stay up all day and all night. You don't miss nothing. Teddy was the best thing. It was like Christmas. You know how on Christmas everybody nice, whether you give or whether you get, it don't matter. It's just Christmas and you feel nice. But that's how the cruise felt for me, man. It was just nice. But Kate, I have a big had a big show over the weekend.
Where?
Makeda Dredd,
Oh,
didn't she do a
yeah.
big she do a big show over the weekend?
Was she
Yeah.
celebrating her birthday?
I did that show with Fully in them.
Oh,
Brandon
nice.
Stemmett, sorry. And
Yeah.
Michael Hyde and Fully and Tony Chin, and I was the band for four of the artists, the Cables, Johnny Osborne, Johnny Clark, Rankin Joe, Ginger Roots. It was
Nice.
great.
Nice.
Julian Marley was there.
Makeda, that's another name that's definitely written in the book of Cali reggae.
That's
That
right.
it cannot ignore, you know? She's
No.
been there from the beginning, holding it down.
Foundational,
Yeah.
foundational that.
Still standing and still
Yeah.
holding it down.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
All right. Well, this has been a very wonderful show. Thank you so much, Fabian, for sharing your history, which is really incredible, and there's still more to come.
It's still more to come. We're not even cover everything. We're gonna have to
Yeah.
do a part two, man.
Well, you probably to cover me, you probably are gonna need about 10 parts. Because you just got the pre-Jamaica, you know, the early, but there's been so
Yeah,
much.
that must say.
Because there's a whole lot of chapter where I stepped away from the reggae thing and I was doing a lot of R&B and hip
We
hop,
didn't touch
pop,
on
and all
that at
that stuff.
all.
You know, there's just so much, you know. And I was telling Mashariki with my bio, it took me days to try and get it down to one page because there was just so much in it, you know. So just to figure out what to keep and what not to keep, because there's just so much people over the years or so much. And I feel blessed, you know. At this point, I can look back at it and go, you know, I've been a part of some real blessings, you know. Some people I worked with, some of the people who, you know, that like even when I was working with Max Romeo, I didn't really realize who Max Romeo was
Whoa.
until after I started working. I mean, I knew his song and I knew, but I didn't understand the importance that he had worldwide on it,
Right?
you know. And it's a beautiful thing, you know. And I've been a part of a lot of first times and foundations, you know. The same thing with even out here being a part of the building of it. It's the same thing in New York. I was a part of that whole foundation of building that thing in New York. When I went to New York, I remember you see a dread on the street, you'd be like, "Yo, that's a dread. Who that?" You know. Now everywhere, now everywhere you go,
Everywhere.
you know, it was, you know, it's just interesting, you know. But I remember introducing reggae, talking about reggae, and people are like, "Reggae, what do you mean, Reggae?" What? They had no clue what it was, you know. Now it's a household thing, and everybody knows
Right.
what it is, you know.
Reggaeton.
Yeah, everybody got their own version of reggae now.
Yes. And I listen to a lot of, because I work in a predominantly Latino community. I hear a lot of reggaeton, and it's nothing but dance hall rhythms. They just sing over it in Spanish, but it's the same rhythms. It blows my. I've been
Same
trying to
thing.
get Blaze Mob to do a version of Twist and Shout and La Bamba, but they don't listen to me.
Oh, God, that look on Jazzy's face was priceless.
Yeah, that
Yeah, man, reach out to that Latino markets.
And you know what, though? I don't mean to extend the thing too much, but one of the things I learned real quick early on, I used to work for all these record companies, and I remember these, you know, people coming to me, these A&R companies come there, and they'd play me these songs and go, "Yo, we want something like this, we want something like that," and whatever. And I'm sitting there thinking to myself, by the time you get this out, people move on past that, you know. One thing I've learned is you have to be real and true to yourself. You have to be who you are. Stop, you know, you can't follow trends or what anybody, you know, you have to just do what you do. Now, if you don't know where you're going and you have no direction, you just want to follow some trend, that's one thing. But, you know, you got to be real to who you are, and people will always appreciate that a lot more.
Rastafari. That's definitely how Garty was.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. All right, good family.
Yes.
This was an excellent podcast. We really thank Fabian. We want to give thanks to you so much for lifting up our program, eh?
I love
My
that.
goodness, I feel like we're really, really sharing some very important information.
Yeah.
Very, very enriching. Appreciate it.
I love, love. Anytime.
And sometimes when we have people on and they're doing a project or a show, we will go show up to give some support. So if you're doing anything out there, let us know. And the Roots Reggae Reasoning crew will show up to give the eye support here.
I love mine. I appreciate that.
You gonna play some music, Rashaki?
Reggae Reasoning Sessions with Hope.